Well, you know, Johnny always wore black, and he wore black because he identified with the poor and the downtrodden.
You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time.
And welcome to Radio Free Canada. It's October 2nd. I'm Kevin Anich, your host. Welcome to all of you. What's done in the dark will be brought to the light. Amen, brothers and sisters. That's why we're here today, to bring it to the light. And not only to bring the truth to the light, but to arm all of us to take action, to push back the darkness. We're here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern at the BBS Radio Network. You can write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. Today, the face of genocide in Canada and around the world, we're going to focus on mercury poisoning by various corporations. An eyewitness to this, Sean Pelletier, one of our organizers in Toronto, Canada, will be coming on the air in a few minutes to talk about the campaign, especially on Indian reservations, which are targeted for major toxic waste dumps in Canada. And we're going to be also going into more detail about the historic memorandum going out to 32 nations. You can read it at itccs.org, the tribunal website, the International Tribunal and the Crimes of Church and State. itccs.org, go to it. This very historic posting goes into detail. It's called the Historic Continuity of Genocide in Canada. It describes the hard evidence showing that genocide has never stopped in Canada, that, for example, the Indian residential school crimes are carrying on at the hands of the same men and women who caused those crimes, the top leadership of the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches still involved in these crimes. Also, the missing women on the west coast of Canada, that's now the subject of a so-called yet another government inquiry, which has turned into yet another cover-up. This missing women whole issue is ignoring the fact that the Native women who have gone missing and continue to go missing, along with their entire families, especially in northern BC, these women are politically targeted. They're being assassinated because they are tied into the traditional matrilineal clan mother system that had ownership of the lands and resources. And if you're a Chinese or Japanese or American corporation and you want to get the natives off the land, you've got to target these leaders. So, in effect, it's a campaign of political assassination. We're going to be going into more detail of that. And in terms of announcements, before I bring on Sean Pelletier, Merv Ritchie, one of the West Coast independent media reporters who exposed a lot of the story of the operation of Chinese cartels in British Columbia and their connection to these disappeared Native families, Merv Ritchie was arrested this last week under the cover of the visit of the so-called royal couple, Kate and Andrew. When they're in British Columbia, Merv Ritchie was detained for an entire day by the police as a security threat, along with other people whose, of course, names we'll never know. These so-called royal visits are not only occasions for the disappearance of Native children, but also the targeting of community activists. Now, Merv Ritchie is now being freed. He is going to be interviewed tomorrow about what happened by some of our people in Vancouver. But it's important to realize that people like Merv have brought these stories to light. Now, Merv was the editor of the Terrace Daily News in northern British Columbia. When he began to report of the on the involvement of the Catholic Church in these disappearances historically, the local Knights of Columbus in Terrace, B.C. shut down his publication. They went to the advertisers and scared them all away. They closed down the Terrace Daily News, and Merv has been targeted in other ways since then, including targeted for false arrests and this kind of harassment that he faced this last week. So we're going to have an interview with Merv next week, along with hopefully the two ITCC activists in England who have been targeted and imprisoned in the same way. Also, in other news, the Standing Rock protest carries on in northern, in North Dakota and South Dakota against the energy transfer pipeline that's going through that state. And we're going to have an analysis of that in the coming week based on people who have been there and observing it. Some of the problems that are developing. Now, there is massive solidarity. There's Native groups coming from all over the world now. There's over 5,000 people there, and the Obama government seems to be backing off. They're not enforcing arrest warrants. They're not forcing them off the camp. As a matter of fact, the U.S. Corps of Engineers the Army Corps of Engineers has admitted that the protest is too large for them to seek an eviction order. So there seems to be a stalemate right now. But in British Columbia, there was a similar mass movement called the Clarecourt protest, where thousands of people tried to stop the logging interest, and that was shut down because of an inside deal with the Native leadership. Now, we're not going to assume the same thing is happening in Standing Rock, but there are built-in problems with these kinds of things. So we're going to go into that in more detail next week. And also in the news, which we're going to be, again, have more of an analysis on soon, is the prison strike that is sweeping America now in 24 states, where the slave laborers, under the American law, you are a legal slave if you're an inmate in a prison. You make somewhere between 23 cents and a dollar a day for doing slave labor. A lot of these people are now on strike, and it's spreading. It's even being reported in the corporate media. So we're going to have more updates on that in the next week or two when we have more solid information on that. Now, before I bring on Sean Pelchy, again, I want to remind you all of not only our website, itccs.org, but murderbydecree.com, which is the answer to the Canadian government's cover-up of genocide in Canada, the ongoing genocide. Murder by Decree, the crime of genocide in Canada, unrelenting between Sodom and Zion, and Truth Teller Shield, a manual for whistleblowers, have all been published this last year. You can find them all on Amazon.com, and they're priceless resources in this battle. So I really urge everybody to look at that on Amazon.com. Just look for Kevin Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T, and the books will come up. So without further ado, it's 10 after the hour. We're going to go to Sean. Sean, are you with us?
Hi, how's it going, Kevin?
I'm really good, Sean. How about you?
I'm very good.
Now, I've given a little bit of an intro. Maybe you can just give a little description of who you are, some of, I don't want to say credentials, but, you know, your background and your involvement in this whole issue of mercury poisoning.
I'm an activist. I have participated in some actions around mercury poisoning here in Ontario. I grew up in a mining town in northern Manitoba where the river nearby was poisoned by mercury due to hydroelectric developments on it. And I had friends who suffered from mercury poisoning, and I've just generally been active on the subject for a while now.
Okay, now when you say the effects of mercury poisoning, what are some of these effects? Give us a little bit of a background. I know you've done good research into what mercury poisoning is, where it comes from, and who's responsible. Can you just fill us in a bit?
Okay, so mercury poisoning is a pretty scary thing. It's when mercury enters the body, it tends to target specific molecules which it chemically bonds with. Some of those molecules are psyllium-based enzymes, which are found in myelin, which is the kind of gray matter of the brain. It gets in there, and it begins to disrupt the functioning of the cells to the point where they chemically begin to disintegrate and stop functioning properly. It also affects the liver, where it stops enzymes from in the liver from breaking down things like adrenaline. People end up with an adrenaline overload and heart problems, profuse sweating, and that sort of stuff. But the biggest impact is with the breakdown of our myelin. It causes several diseases, one of which is Hunter-Russell syndrome. Hunter-Russell syndrome tends to impair people's speech, impairs their vision, creates involuntary motor functions. So people end up looking like they're drunk, they slur their speech, they're stumbling around. And it's often mistaken by doctors for multiple sclerosis. In more severe cases, which tend to be prominent on reserves here in Canada, it creates Minamata disease, which it has symptoms like numbness in the hands and feet, general muscle weakness, involuntary motor control, loss of vision, hearing, speech. It leads people to a state of general kind of insanity, and then paralysis, coma, and death. Judy De Silva in Grassy Narrows described people who had suffered there from it as losing their minds, ending up near the end of their lives before they develop paralysis. They end up strapped to hospital beds. And eventually they end up in a coma and pass away. Mercury poisoning is pretty scary for children as well, because pregnant mothers tend to concentrate nutrients in their fetus, but along with the nutrients that they concentrate in the fetus, they will also concentrate mercury. Fetuses in pregnant mothers will end up with a higher mercury level than in their mother. Right. So even with a mother who might have no symptoms of mercury poisoning, the children may end up with diseases resulting from those concentrations. One of them is a chordia. It creates weird sensations in children's bodies. It turns their face pink. There's swelling, skin peeling. I mean, many of our organs, not just our skin, are made out of skin cells, stuff like our lungs and our digestive system. So those things peel and create sores and rashes and stuff like that. Children will end up with loss of teeth, hair, nails. They'll have low muscle tone and poor motor control. They'll be sensitive to sunlight, have kidney problems, will have a lot of emotional problems. They'll cry unexpectedly or get angry unexpectedly, and their memory will be poor, and they'll most likely suffer from insomnia.
Now, Sean, let's talk about, you know, where is this coming from? What causes mercury poisoning? It's obviously a result of industrial activity. Could you talk about who's responsible, the names of the companies, and we'll get into the whole Aboriginal angle as well.
There's some kind of hot centers in Canada for mercury poisoning. One is northwestern Quebec, where there's a lot of gold mining activities in the area, as well as a lot of logging. The mercury comes from the gold processing that takes place in the area, as well as is naturally leached into the water system from deforested areas. It's naturally occurring and is washed into the rivers through soil erosion. Like sawmills and paper factories are a big source of it. In say Val d'Or, there's quite a few gold mining companies that are responsible for mercury leaching into the water. There is QMX Gold Corporation. There's Agnico Eagle Mines Limited, as well as Golden Valley Mines, that are involved in the operations there. Hydro-Québec has a lot of hydroelectric installations there. So when you put in a hydro dam and a reservoir is formed, the naturally occurring mercury in the soil and vegetation there is released into the water in dangerous amounts. And Val d'Or is a kind of an important site for mercury poisoning. It's kind of high up on the river system there, and the mercury flows through the river systems and ends up affecting a lot of reserves up north, including reserves along James Bay and Hudson's Bay.
Right.
Where it bioaccumulates in fish and seals.
Now, you know, Grassy Narrows, of course, is in the news a lot near Kenora in Ontario. Give us an idea in Ontario what's happening with the mercury poisoning.
There, mercury poisoning in Grassy Narrows comes from paper processing plants that were just dumping wastewater into the river system. as well as logging operations that were being carried out by Abitibi and Weyerhaeuser. There is very high concentrations there, definitely another hot spot where people are suffering from severe mercury poisoning.
Weyerhaeuser once again. Hey, they keep cropping up like a dirty sock all over the world. Weyerhaeuser is one of the biggest U.S.-based logging companies in the world.
Absolutely. I think there's been lawsuits against them, like even in Polynesia, for poisoning water there with mercury.
Well, they're the bastards that got rid of me, too. When we found out about the theft of native land at the hands of the United Church, selling it off at the behest of Weyerhaeuser. So, I don't know, it's kind of... anyway, we'll care. That's a whole other story. But tell me a bit about, for people who don't know, Sean, you had some contact with this movement to oppose the poisoning around Grassy Narrows and that. What is the state of that movement now? Are Native people organizing against it? Are there blockades? How are they fighting it?
Grassy Narrows is extraordinarily well organized. There are a lot of folks involved there, as well as from all over Manitoba and Ontario involved in that campaign. Earlier this spring, they held protests out of the Ontario Parliament, where they ended up meeting with some politicians. They have fairly regular gatherings in Grassy Narrows itself, where they carry out educational events, as well as some direct actions from time to time. They'll blockade the Trans-Canada. They've got an occupation site there that's blocking access to some logging areas. I've been out there myself, and the community is quite strong there. And we'll hear a lot from Grassy Narrows about mercury poisoning in this country because of the activism that's being carried out by folks from Grassy.
Well, it's interesting, too, that I noticed that Native groups from Manitoba are going down to Standing Rock, North Dakota, as part of the campaign to stop the pipeline there. And there's this whole merger going on between issues of Indigenous land rights and the environmental movement. There seem to be natural allies there. Do you find that with the Grassy Narrows, that environmental groups are kind of rallying around the people? These are the Cree people, is that right?
In Grassy Narrows, it's mostly Anishinaabe folk.
Anishinaabe, okay.
Yeah. The Cree people are more active in northwestern Quebec with their activism, because the rates of mercury poisoning are similar out there to Grassy Narrows.
And have environmental groups got on board with the different Native groups in Canada?
Absolutely. There is very close ties. When I was in Grassy Narrows, I was there for a eco-justice gathering. It was organized by the Rainforest Action Network. There's very close ties. Since Native people tend to live off of resources that are found in the natural river and lake systems and forests, they've found a way to make nature economically viable for themselves, and industry that moves in challenges that a great deal. Like in Grassy, when there was the anti-fur trade sort of campaigns in the early 90s, the trap lines ended up being lost around Grassy because people stopped buying fur. But what happened was that Weyerhaeuser and Abitibi moved in and clear-cut the area, so the trap lines were replaced by clear-cut land, and the animals didn't benefit in any way. So there is definitely a strong need for Indigenous people to work with environmental groups to make the extraction of resources from nature environmentally sustainable.
Now, we know that, often, these big multinationals just ignore the law. They go in to log in an area, even though they don't have a permit. You know, they get a little fine slapped on them, but they carry on. So have you seen any big results as a result of this, or is it just people kind of battling against this monolith?
Well, not much ground has been made against illegal corporate activities. There was illegal dumping of mercury in the river system around Grassy. The companies were sued. The money was put into trust, and then it seemed to disappear. Also, there's illegal poaching of logs in the area, and the municipal governments there, as well as the police force, do nothing to stop it. People from Grassy have followed logging trucks from illegal clear cuts to the factories in the area, and have plenty of evidence for the poaching of logs, but nothing is done.
Well, you know, it's kind of, we keep running up against the whole issue of dealing with the corporatocracy, where the corporations run things. And classic example was out in my former hometown of Nanaimo, British Columbia. The watershed was being polluted by, again, Weyerhaeuser in their logging practices. They logged off all the trees, and so the runoff from the fertilizer they used in tree planting had toxic waste in it, including mercury and other garbage. And it was running right into the drinking water of the city of Nanaimo. Well, people went to the city, and they said, you got to do something about this. We're being poisoned by Weyerhaeuser. And the city council said, well, they own the watershed. The city doesn't. The company owns the watershed. They can do whatever they want to. Sorry, you're going to have to be poisoned, in effect, what they said over 12 years ago. Now, we find this all over, that the actual municipalities don't own the water. The company does. Do you find that in Ontario?
Much of Ontario's water rights have been bought by corporations like Nestle, as well as a lot of other bottling companies. I'm not entirely sure if that's the case around Grassy. I think the pollution was just simply illegally dumped into the river system there, without any water rights or any legal go-ahead.
So, I mean, you know, we're literally being poisoned by the system, and here's a classic example. You know, you've been on the ground with this, I think, for years, Sean. You've been working on this. What kind of personal price do people pay for this? Like, I know there has been stories of police harassment and that kind of thing. Have you faced that kind of opposition in this campaign?
Absolutely. While I was in Grassy, the occupation site was raided by the police. A few people were arrested. Those who were arrested were beaten severely. Even a good friend of mine ended up being beaten into having a miscarriage. So the terrorism conducted by the Ontario Police Force is quite brutal. And it was no different in Val-d'Or. There's a long record of the Indigenous communities around the polluted water sources being terrorized by police force, and most of it targets women. There's quite a lot of assaults and sexual assaults by police force on the reserves around Val-d'Or, around Kenora, Ontario, which is just south of Grassy Narrows, as well as around Thunder Bay, which also has its own logging and mercury problems.
Have these been documented, these attacks? We're talking the Ontario Provincial Police. The RCMP, are they involved?
Yeah, and the QP. It's not just Ontario.
Right. Thursday in Quebec.
It's been documented, but it's very difficult to get justice when the crimes are being committed by the police force. So they continue, and it's still an ongoing problem.
So, as it stands right now, have these practices ever been curtailed when we're talking about, you know, the poisoning of the land and the water systems? Have there been victories? Have they actually been stopped and it made better in any way?
No, not at all. The mercury poison seems to be getting worse. I mean, the logging activities around Grassy are intensifying, And in northwestern Quebec, one thing that has been gained through activism was the installation of dialysis center, which helps people who are suffering with diabetes to to alleviate the symptoms of it. It was installed because a while ago, Hydro-Québec, along with the Cree Grand Council, launched a don't eat the fish campaign, and so people stopped eating fish, and some reserves went from a rate of diabetes of 3 cases to 800 when folks on the reserves stopped eating the fish and moved to store-bought food. So, I mean, that was the biggest success that I could find in terms of dealing with the problems of mercury poisoning, which is not much of a success at all. Out in Labrador, there's a campaign against Muskrat Falls hydroelectric dam project, and what the folks out there are asking for, they're Inuit folks. They are asking for the soil and the vegetation to be removed from the reservoir site, so that it won't release mercury into the water and poison their food supply. The project is expected to cost something like $11 billion, and the removal of soil and vegetation is a trivial amount in contrast to that price tag. And the government as well as the company are refusing to do that. They're fully intending on completing this project, which is supposed to be done in 2019. They've done studies and they expect the rate of mercury to increase to 1,500 percent the safe limits for mercury in the area.
It's criminal, so, and I mean, you know, tell me again who the criminals are here. List the corporations involved doing this again.
Oh, there are so many. There's Dow Chemical in Southern Ontario. There's Abitibi Logging, Weyerhaeuser, Dryden Pulp and Paper, Dryden Chemical Company, Resolute Forest Products. Let me see.
The hydro companies. Hydro-Québec, Ontario Hydro, and that.
Yeah, Hydro Ontario, Quebec, and Manitoba are responsible for poisoning reserves. There's a bunch of mining companies as well. Domtar Paper releases a lot of mercury in northwestern Quebec. And so there's quite a lot of them that are responsible. But the common factor really is the government. Governments give these companies a go ahead to do this, even though the technology and the knowledge to contain the mercury as well as just not release it in the first place has been around for a very, very long time, and it's not that expensive to keep mercury out of the water. However, these things continue, and it continually creates a push factor for people living on reserves to leave, because it makes life pretty well unbearable if you have to if you lose your source of food, and you're dealing with a whole bunch of illnesses that result from living in those areas.
Now, do you think Native people are being deliberately targeted in this way? We know, like in America, something like 80% of all the toxic waste dumps are either near Chicano, Native, or Black communities. Do you think this is environmental racism, environmental genocide going on?
Absolutely. I think Val-d'Or is a very good example of that. There's a Noranda smelter nearby there. There's two watersheds, one going north to the reserves and another going south through the Ottawa Valley, and it seems like they dumped their tailings northward towards the reserves. They make a clear choice to do it. The smelter itself is on the Ottawa drainage basin, but they must redirect the tailings to the river system that goes up north to James Bay and affects tons of reserves.
How many years has this been going on then, Sean? I mean, how far back does this date? that this has been going on with the mercury poisoning?
I think the deliberate mercury poisoning goes back at least to the 60s or 70s, when awareness about the effects of mercury first came around.
I remember back in the 70s, there was these horrible pictures from Japan, which is where the Minamata name comes from, because the Minamata, Japan, there was some big mercury spill or something, these horrible pictures of people with contorted limbs and facial, you know. And so that got a lot of exposure then, and then suddenly it died off, so I'm assuming it's never stopped.
The scientist that coined the name for the disease actually came over to Ontario and did studies here too, and actually came up with like a sub-disease called the Ontario Minamata disease. Right from that time, there was a widespread awareness that mercury was affecting people, and since then, the pollution, at least towards reserves, has only intensified.
Well, I know one of the things that one of our listeners wrote to me about when they heard this topic was coming on the air today, he said, find out the names of the heads of these corporations, find out where they live, find out the insurance companies that are underwriting these corporations. Start a campaign aimed at the insurance companies. You take away their insurance coverage and these companies run, and you put personal liens on the accounts of these corporate officers, hit them where it counts, it's going to be a lot more effective than a protest up on a logging road. So what do you think of those kinds of tactics?
You would require a legal system that would help you do that. From all indications that I've seen, the justice system gives slaps on the wrist and allows these things to continue. I wish that was a solution, but I can't really see it happening. I think local communities really need to have control over the economic activity that's taking place within them.
Right.
Which
there's not a recourse through the present legal system, is what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely not. The legal system has been around since the 70s. There's been tons of lawsuits. There's been tons of government research into this stuff, and nothing has taken place. And I think folks have been fairly creative about how they've confronted these corporations and have used pretty well every means possible beyond just simply taking out their guns and shutting them down.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of leading to a whole interesting discussion, which we don't have time for today, but which is a theme in our program, the common law, how people can use it to convene their own common law courts locally, take local action, is what you're saying. Any kind of thoughts about that or how it relates to this whole issue?
That would be a good start. And then there's plenty of evidence out there. Like I was saying, these things have been studied quite a bit. So I could see common law courts easily convicting the heads of these corporations, and then it would just be a matter of enforcement from there.
And that's the big issue. Enforcement. And, you know, one of the things we were hoping to do on the show, Sean, as you know, over the kind of the weeks and months ahead, is do kind of training workshops to tell people, well, here's how you can go about it. Ultimately, it comes down to force. We need our own common law sheriffs. We need one of the things being put out this week in our memorandum about ongoing genocide in Canada, which is going out to Russia and other countries. We're calling on international peacekeeping forces to come to Canada. So, I mean, for example, when you know people are being attacked by the OPP in Ontario and a woman being forced to miscarriage, this brutality, that's the situation where you need international peacekeepers to come in and monitor an area and protect the people. What do you think of that idea?
That would be absolutely fantastic, especially if they're willing to enforce the common law court decisions, because as of today, I don't know of any criminal charges laid against the people responsible for poisoning the water systems around reserves. I mean, despite the mass crime of poisoning, which in the case of mercury poisoning is absolutely horrific, there's been no criminal charges brought against people who have been clearly responsible for it. So that coupled with the court system would be along the lines of what we'd need.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely, I mean, I'm really glad we're leading into this, because people will often get a sense of despair, like, what can you do against the system when it's a stacked deck? Well, we have to create our own system. And I know it's a hard job on the ground when you're starting to create something new, but I don't really see any other alternative. And from the way you're describing it today, this is even more proof.
Yeah, I fully agree. It's a super difficult job, but it's well worthwhile. I mean, it would even only address the problems of mercury poisoning. There's problems across the board. Mercury poisoning is only the tip of the iceberg. So creating a solution that will work is, I think, the right idea.
Now, you're a resident of Toronto. Of course, this isn't just an issue out in the boonies on Indian reservations, obviously, that are being targeted for this. What kind of stuff do you encounter, like in cities? Is there this kind of mercury poisoning threat, say, in a place like Toronto?
As far as I'm aware, mercury poisoning is not a big threat in Toronto. We have a wide variety of poisons that show up in our water supply. We've got lead. Windshield washer fluid is probably the largest threat, but we've got lots of pharmaceuticals that are entering the water supply. As far as I'm aware, like, the best our treatment system does is just chemically neutralize things. So we get a whole bunch of weird salts from the neutralization of acid and base industrial pollution that end up in our water and likely have a negative impact on us.
People ask me this often. Are there things you can actually get in a health food store that neutralize the effect of stuff in the water, whether it be lead or, any of the other garbage?
I don't believe so. I mean, when you're talking about neutralizing an element that might be in our water, there's, like, filters are not quite that good. I mean, you could do reverse osmosis or, like, hydroelectrolysis or something like that. Mm-hmm. Those things are very expensive. Unless we have the money for those things, we're stuck drinking contaminated water.
Yeah, well, sometimes I will put out a bucket at night and just drink the rainwater, but, who wants fluoride in their system? Do you know what degree or what percentage of Canadian cities use fluoride in the water?
It's been reduced a lot. I'm not too sure, but from what I understand, there's been a lot of reduction in the use of fluoride. I haven't looked into it that much. I do have a government report on fluoride in the waters, the drinking water on reserves, and it states that there is significant overdosing of fluoride. I'm not too sure of the health effects of that. I can't imagine they're good.
But
fluoride's definitely a poison, but I don't think it's a big problem in communities that are not reserves anymore.
Right, like individual municipalities can vote not to have it in, I believe. It doesn't have to be the feds, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other? We've got about three more minutes before we're going to sign you off, and we're going to just have a few audio clips and me signing off the show. But is there anything else you want to say on this issue or anything else, Sean?
I think I've covered a lot of it.
Sure have.
I just wanted to draw attention to some of the activism going on out in BC around the Site C Dam. The Peace River is going to be dammed with a large hydroelectric dam, even though studies have shown that there would be cheaper options. However, the Site C Dam will displace, I think, 8 reserves and flood farmland and flood about 78 Native heritage sites. And as far as I know, I think approval of that dam project is still going through. So if people want to get involved with that campaign and potentially stop it from coming about, they can visit stopsitec.org.
Stopsitec.org?
Yeah.
No, is that Alcan, or what company is that?
It's BC Hydro.
BC, oh, those. Oh, God. We've got lots. We could focus many shows on what's going on. They link between, you know, environmental assaults and racism and the missing Native families in BC. They're all interlinked, and we're going to get into that more. But, Sean, I really appreciate all the valuable information and experience you have that you brought on the air today, and we do want you back, and also on other issues. Feel free. This is your program as well as all of ours. And so thank you. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
Take care.
Talk to you soon. Okay.
Bye.
That was Sean Pelchy from Toronto, worked with our Common Law Network and the Republic of Kanata Network. If you want to comment on anything you've heard today, Republic of Kanata, that's K-A-N-A-T-A, Republic of Kanata at gmail.com. Kanata, by the way, is, for those who are wondering, is where the word Canada comes from. It was a Haudenosaunee word, that's the Six Nations Iroquois, they're sometimes called. The Haudenosaunee name meaning where the people sit as equals around the longhouse fires. And, you know, it suggests to me, and the original meaning of our country was supposed to be that equality. You know, the Tuareg Wampum Treaty that established equality between the original inhabitants here and the European settlers, that's been, of course, thrown out. We see genocide, as we've just been describing today, at every level of society. And people often say, well, where's the proof? The proof is everywhere, and we've been documenting it for over 20 years now. And I'm about to play two audio clips from our documented case that we took to Europe that resulted in the conviction of Queen Elizabeth, Pope Benedict, Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and 27 other people for crimes against humanity. You can see that at itccs.org. At the top of the masthead, go to Common Law Court Case Number 1, Genocide in Canada. You'll see all of this evidence, not just documents, but people's eyewitness testimonies about crimes of murder, sterilization, medical experimentation, mass murder in these Indian residential schools, where not a single person has ever been brought to trial in the Canada Crown courts for any of these crimes. So we're going to listen to two of these taken from the video information given to the court in Brussels that convicted Canada for these crimes. We'll listen to those, and I'll be right back after that.
Across the country in Ontario, Lorna McNaughton, a survivor of the Anglican Indian School in Brantford, relates how her brother witnessed the mass killing of Mohawk children by Canadian soldiers near the Mohawk School in the year 1943. Video Exhibit 32.
Our dorm was just full of girls. And he said, yeah, so was ours full of boys. And he said, do you know what happened to them? And I said, no. And he said, they called in the army and they took them to the army base and they shot them. They stood them all along this big hole and they shot them. And when the bullets hit them, they fell into the hole. And he said, when they were all done, he said, those that hadn't fallen into the hole, some of them were still alive. He said, some of them were still alive in the hole. And he said, they came along. I want to say a bulldozer. That what comes to my mind, but I'm not really sure that my brother had said a bulldozer. They came along with a big machine anyway, and they shoved them all in that big hole and covered it up. And he says, that's what happened to them. And I must have been about 8, I guess, or 7 or 8, somewhere through there. Let's see, that must have been 43 or 44.
And Harry Wilson and Dennis Tellio Both survivors of the United Church Indian School in Port Alberni told reporters in 2005 how they discovered the dead bodies of children on the grounds of the Alberni School, in video exhibit number 27.
In 65, there's a bunch of us kids playing soccer in the backfield. There was a brush of leaves and grass piled up, and there was a body underneath it. One of the kids kicked the ball, and he went to get it. It was quite decomposed.
Went to Port Alberni in 1960, and I would, I found a dead body in 1967 in between Ross Hall and Kawa Hall. Native girl, she was about 16, and I told Jay Andrews, and Jay Andrews shipped out of Port Alberni, went to Nanaimo, and I believe it was a cover.
These stories are everywhere, and in the case of Lorna McNaughton describing Canadian soldiers shooting Mohawk children in the year 1943 or 44, we have confirmed that the site called the Glebe Site contains the remains of human bones. That was confirmed by several of the Mohawk elders at the very time that we were excavating similar remains right next to the Anglican Mohawk School in October and November of 2011, just before the government shut down that excavation. Now, the Glebe site, where these bones of these children who were shot are contained, have now been sold. Get this, the land at the Glebe site, where these children are buried, have been sold to an Arab investor who showed up last year and started work with Mohawk elders about buying up all of this land. So, for some reason, the Mohawks are selling off these mass grave sites to moneyed interest over in Saudi Arabia. We're going to look into that more. Harry Wilson, who reported, as you just heard his voice, describing when he found the body of that young girl at the Alberni Residential School, he was then put in a psychiatric hospital after he reported it. He said Jay Andrews, that's Principal John Andrews of the United Church, who did go to trial. He actually only did 6 months in jail for covering up these murders. And the United Church skillfully negotiated so that the whole issue of murder was left off the statement that went into the public record. This kind of cover-up is consistent, and we find it everywhere. So as we talked about with Sean Peltier just now, what do you do when you are part of a system that committed mass murder, that's continuing to kill children and others? Because once the crime has been committed and never stopped, it'll carry on. We know that. And, you know, I came across a quote from Abraham Lincoln the other day, and it said, it was written just after the Civil War began in America. He said, "In times like the present, men should utter nothing for which they would not willingly be responsible through time and eternity." So when we say we want justice, do we really want it? Are we going to be held responsible for the knowledge we have now that we are walking on a huge crime scene called Canada, as many other countries in the world, but we are here in Canada, and we are complicit if we don't do anything about it. Now, you know, we know what to do. We've already shown what to do. We not only document the crime, but we take action when the courts are complicit, as they have been from the very beginning, not just in these crimes against children, but any crime. The courts are not lawful anymore because they don't operate according to the rule of law. Anyone who tries to go through the court system finds it out very quickly. They get kicked in their teeth. We know fraud and corruption is operating at every level of the court system, the worst being, of course, the family court system, where children are openly trafficked. Vulnerable families are identified, especially if you're a poor single mom. You're targeted. Your child is taken from you under some pretext. And agencies like the Canadian Children's Aid Society in Ontario, which is not even a government operation, it's an offshore private company that gets $100,000 from the Ontario government for every child they traffic into a foster home. So like with private prisons, there's a profit motive here to grab children and traffic them. And it's being done through a compliant legal system as well. That whole legal system is the problem. It's the big barrier to justice. And so when Crown law or admiralty law that we are dominated by now in Canada is openly criminal by its nature and in the way it operates, then we have to create our own legal system. That's the Nuremberg precedent. That's Magna Carta going back over 1,000 years, that the people are the source of not just the law, but sovereignty. That was the whole basis of the American Revolution. And the Founding Fathers saying, we are the people, the king isn't, we are the law. So we enact that. We have a whole system in place for training people in the common law. Go to itccs.org, look in the right-hand column. You'll see the common law training manual. It shows you how to set up a common law court on any issue. And so we are calling now for people to do this. We'll be using the months ahead to train you folks online here on Radio Free Canada on how to bring about common law court cases. We're going to be having several test cases having to do with the Children's Aid Society. We have people working on programs now, radio programs, documenting these crimes by the Children's Aid Society, their own experience of it, and what we can do to issue stand-down orders and arrest warrants against these Children's Aid Societies, police, and others who are trafficking children. We are issuing and close to remind you to go to itccs.org, read the memorandum on the continuity of genocide in Canada. That document and all the exhibits that accompany it are going out to 32 nations this week, including to Vladimir Putin and Russia. We're calling on President Putin to provide international peacekeepers to come to Canada to protect us on the line who are risking our lives for our children and to save the earth, and to convict the parties that are already proven to be guilty in our common law courts. There's standing arrest warrants against 30 officials. These arrest warrants need to be enforced. We need to stop war crimes in Canada. So please do the education. Follow our work every Sunday here, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. Spread the word. Get your friends to listen to the archive. All the shows are archived at bbsradio.com/Radio Free Canada. We have only ourselves to blame if these things carry on. We know the nature of the beast. The problem isn't the system being the way it is, because wolves operate according to, act like wolves. The problem is, what are we going to do to stop it? And we have given people a model of how to do that. So I want to thank you again for tuning in. We're going to end now on one of my favorite songs, Stand By Me, because it isn't just about judgment coming down, as Johnny Cash reminded us with the opening song. God sees these things. God's natural justice acts through us if our hearts and minds are open to receive and to act in that spirit. And the question now is, are we going to stand by each other? And that's the question faced every day. Are you going to stand by that child that's trafficked tomorrow? Are you going to stand by the people like Merv Ritchie who are being targeted simply because they're reporting the truth? Your answer, it lies in your hands. Thank you for tuning in, brothers and sisters. Until next week, stay strong, stay clear. We'll see you next week.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.